So we're in looking at Romans chapter 13. And my iPad said software update available, so I don't want that. That would be the worst thing that could happen this morning, believe me. Yeah, that's right. And we're going to read verses 1 through to 10, Romans 13. It won't be on the screen. Romans 13, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Please notice that. Verse 2, consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. For rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, everyone smile. For the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Verse 8. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another, for whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. That's the law of Moses, by the way, not the law of the land. Although, there is some implication there. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other commandments there may be, are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Verse 10, love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. Okay, let's have a wee look at this. It's been said, and I just want to recap this, because we've been doing a series on Romans, and we're kind of coming to the end of the 16 chapters, so we're up to number 13. We're coming to the end, but I just want to recap and to remind you that Paul, when he was writing Romans and addressing the new church in Rome, this fledgling church that had been around for about, I don't know, 30 years, 40 years maybe, because Christ did, this was written at about 54 AD. So the church had been established, and Jesus had gone back to heaven, been crucified, rose, and gone back to heaven. And so this is a new fledgling church, and they're operating in the city of Rome. And Paul essentially was proclaiming to them again in the book of Romans, essentially the whole gospel message. What does gospel mean? Good news. So what Jesus taught when he was alive on earth, Paul is essentially repeating here in Romans, in the book of Romans. And what he is saying is that their spiritual faith in Christ also has practical implications in daily life. In Romans, Paul explains that their newfound faith is not just about what you believe. There is another step beyond believing. We must believe first. But then beyond that, it's also about what we do with what we believe. So we're now moving from believing, which is essential to become a follower of Jesus, but Jesus believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, died, rose again, and sits at the right hand of the Father, and he will return again for his people, that believing that stuff. But not only just believing it, but then that should be evidence in a change of behavior. From believing, have you got this church, to behavior. And the first seven verses, Paul's opening focus is on the first of this behaving issue that he wants them to understand. And he essentially says, Christians are to submit themselves to governmental authorities. Verse 1, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. Then he gives two reasons why believers must do so. The first is Because actually, God has appointed them, number one. And the second reason is because these authorities, listen, with God's blessing, will punish people who do not obey them. Verse 2, consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. How are you all feeling? Everyone good this morning? Okay, let's unpack what Paul is saying here. And hopefully we're going to get a better understanding of what on the surface seems to be very one-sided and even unfair. In this world, there is both legitimate authority and illegitimate authority. Hold that thought. In this world, there is both legitimate authority, which Paul is talking about, and there is illegitimate authority. Let me give you an illustration. When I left school, age 17, couldn't wait to get out there in the working world, and I thought to myself, well, I've gone through the sixth form. I wasn't going to go to university. That's a bit of a regret for me, actually. I probably should have, but I didn't. I wanted to get out there in the working world, earn some money, and make my own way in life. How many of you were like that? Were, not the ones that are 17. How many of you were? There's a few of us are going to make my own way in life. And my rationale was simply this. I was going to join the Royal New Zealand Air Force because this was my rationale. The training was second to none because in the military, time is not money. If you're working in secular society where you're working for a firm or whatever it happens to be, time is money. That's true, eh? So if you made a mistake, that's going to cost the firm. Well, in the military, they could care less. So time was not money. And the training was second to none, it really was. You were well looked after, you had free accommodation, they provided you with three free meals a day, free accommodation, absolutely wonderful as far as I was concerned. The salary was kind of, back in those days, was kind of okay, but it wasn't bad. Had a great superannuation scheme, especially if you did your 20 years, which I did the 20 years and took my golden handshake and said, thanks very much, government, this is wonderful, and we got on with our life. And then there was the possibility of serving overseas if you were lucky enough, and I was one of those lucky enough. Got a 2-year posting to Singapore, attached to the army in a blue uniform. That was fun, believe me. I was overseas for a couple of years, and sport, if you were into sports, oh my goodness me, I mean, that was a high value and still is a high value in the military. It's a big deal, and particularly if you were in, if you played, you know, the big three, rugby, cricket, and I can't remember what the other one was because it didn't involve me. Don't even worry about it. But I was kind of in the rugby in a big way and was lucky enough to be selected for the New Zealand Armed Forces side. So that was all the armed forces together. We had a team that toured Southeast Asia. And I got to play in that team. I was the number 8, in fact. And loved every minute of it. Went through China, Thailand, goodness me, where else did we go? We went to Malaysia through there, Brunei, you know, the oil place, Brunei. That was a two-day holiday. It was absolutely wonderful. So anyway, all of the stuff was there. It was a pretty good lark as far as I was concerned, looking from the outside in. I signed up, arrived at Woodburn Air Base, which is in Blenheim, on April the 17th, 1974. I will never forget this day. Arrived there by train, and there were 167 other young fellas from all over New Zealand. There were no females in this intake. They were all guys. That's just the way it was. Arrived from all over New Zealand, none of us really having a clue what we'd just signed up to. Not a clue. So we arrived in Blenheim, and waiting to receive us was the serious-looking guy called Sergeant Robinson. He had very short hair. In fact, he had no hair at all. I had long hair, by the way, down to my shoulders. Had a moustache, long hair. That was the days where, you know, that was the in thing. It's not now, but can you imagine it? I should have put a photo, shouldn't I? You know, right down to my shoulders and all of that. And most of the other guys that were there were exactly the same. You know, we're all dressed in our civilian clothes and all, because we hadn't actually signed the dotted line, that the attestation, what they call the attestation, hadn't done that. So here's this guy, Robinson, and he's there in his uniform, pristine, straight as a die, got the stripes on and all the rest of that stuff, and he's waiting there for us, and he's got this smirk on his face. That should have been a sign for me right there. I should have turned around, gotten back on the train and went back to Christchurch. But I didn't. I thought, okay, oh well, you know. I mean, 17 years of age, what do you know at age 17? Well, that's right. That's right. That's absolutely true. Listen to the 17-year-old, 16, 15, 18. You think that you're the masters of the universe. That's what they think. And I thought exactly that too. I can handle this, no problem at all. So there we go. That's what you think when you're 17. How foolish was I? There we go, out of the mouths of babes. Isn't that wonderful? Anyone here seen the movie An Officer and a Gentleman? Put your hand up. Great movie. Who's starring in it? Richard Gere, Deborah Winger, and a guy called Louis Gossett Jr. If you remember the movie, let me give it to you, just a brief overview. Louis Gossett played the role of the tough Sergeant Foley, whose stated goal in life was to push every recruit so hard that any emotional or physical weakness that they carried would be exposed, and they would request a D.O.R. He'd walk up to them, because he's American, "I want your D.O.R., boy." That's what he would say. Discharge on request. That's what it meant. Picture the tough Sergeant Foley in the movie and replace him with Sergeant Robinson. Do you get the picture? Well, because we'd all joined as cadets rather than adult recruits, we had 8 months of this guy to look forward to. And his job was to find our weaknesses. His job was to exploit them. And if he could, have you request for an early discharge. And some of the lads did exactly that. Absolutely. Out of 168 of us that started, I think 30-odd banged out. After about 3 or 4 weeks, they were gone. I stayed, fortunately or unfortunately, but I stayed, and so did the other lads. So on the issue of legitimate authority and illegitimate authority, let me give you an illustration. I recall one Friday night as cadets over there in Blenheim, and you could tell that we were cadets in the Air Force because we had the short hair. And every Friday night, that was our one night, our one time where we had some relative freedom, so they would bus us into town from the base, and we were allowed 2 or 3 hours to wander around and do whatever we needed to do, and then the bus would take us back, and we had to be checked in when we got back and all that kind of stuff. We had about 3 hours. So we'd go into town, and that was kind of just one of those things. And of course, you'd get into a little bit of trouble because the local lads, they knew who you were, and you knew who they were, and all that kind of banter went on, but that's fine. It was all. Anyway, two of my friends, Austin and Martin. And Austin and Martin, that's right. That's true. But Martin was Welsh, so we called him Taffy. So Aussie and Taffy, Austin and Taffy, we decided, we're 17 years of age. The drinking age in those days was 20. I think it was 20 in those days. It wasn't 18, so it must have been 20. We decided, hey, we're making our way in life. This is us. We're young men. I mean, we're in the military, for goodness sakes. We're going to go and have a beer together. So we chose, does anyone know Blenheim, the layout of Blenheim? Do you know the Grove Tavern in Grovetown? Well, the Grove Tavern was about, 20, 30 minutes walk from the centre of town. We figured if we walked there, we could get there, we could go up to the bar, we could get a beer, sit down together, have a drink, walk back and catch the bus and go home, no problem. Get the picture? And we did exactly that. The three of us wandered down there, bold as brass, there's the Grove pub, walked inside. I mean, they were happy to take our money. Our money was as good as anyone else. They didn't care we were underage, nor did we for that matter, at least at that point. Bought the beer, went and sat down at the table, took a sip each, and about 10 seconds later, this guy comes straight over to our table, standing in front of us, and I looked up, and guess who it was? Sergeant Robinson. And he looked at us and he said, "You lads are under arrest." "You've got to be kidding me. You're under arrest. You've broken the rules." So he arrested us on the spot, ordered a taxi for us. This is a military arrest, by the way. Ordered a taxi for us to go back to the base where the guards would be waiting for us and they would take us into custody. And that's exactly what happened. And you know what made matters really worse? We had to pay for the jolly taxi. Really. But here's the thing. Sergeant Robinson had legitimate authority. He wasn't a Christian. He just had legitimate authority. And he was using it. And that's the same authority that Paul is describing here in Romans. It's the same authority. This authority that Paul is talking about in chapter 13 is not whether the person exercising the authority is a Christian or not. It has nothing to do with whether you agree with them or even like them. I didn't like the man at all. In fact, I hated him. And it certainly had nothing to do with how it made you feel. You know, I did not enjoy the open arrest. Or listen to this, the 14 days of extra duties, because on the Monday we got charged, had to go up before the camp commandant in our best uniform, and we were charged in the military way, and we were given what they call 14 days confined to camp, and so we had to do our normal day's work, and then we would work through till 10 o'clock at night, cleaning showers and toilets and floors with a toothbrush, and that kind of thing. And you worked till 10 o'clock at night, and at the end of 10 o'clock, you'd have to parade in your number 3 dress, which was your best uniform, and it had to be spotless and all the lines in the right place, because if that didn't happen, you were in more trouble, and you'd parade and do that, and then you could go to bed to be up again at 5 o'clock the next morning to repeat the whole thing for 14 days straight. No time off for good behavior, and Saturday and Sunday was just a normal working day, 14 days straight. You know, the word extra duties in the military is code for punishment. That's what happened. And here's the thing. My disobeying a legitimate command from someone who is exercising God-given authority. Verse 1. For there is no authority except that which God has established. And I disobeyed it. The other two. And sooner or later, if you're going to go down that rabbit hole, it is going to cost you. Sooner or later, you're going to get caught out. And we did. But Paul goes on to say, and I'll paraphrase this, verse 2. But if you do what's right under legitimate authority, I've put the words in there, legitimate authority. If you do what's right, you will never have to live in fear. Verse 3. For rulers hold no fear. Or no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from the fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right and you will be commended. Paul here is not suggesting that blind obedience to every mandate governing authorities issue. You know what the word submit in the Greek actually means here? Paul uses it not as a simple, it's not an equivalence to obey. It's not what it is. The word, here's some English for you. To submit, you know the word sub means to come under, subway, go under the road or under the railway tracks, a subway, to come under. And the word mit is Latin for to send. Put them both together. Submit is to recognize your subordinate place in a legitimate hierarchy who send or make legal decrees. upon you or the nation or whoever, their legitimate authority. Whether the person or the authority is Christian or not is irrelevant, as I found out. By the way, in the 8 months that I was there, do you think I learned the lesson from the 14 days confined to camp? Nope. A couple of other things happened, but that's another message. Moving on. In Titus 3:1, Paul says this, "Remind the people to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready to do whatever is good." Not what's bad. Not when we are when illegitimate authority, and we'll get to that in a minute, imposes something that you know is completely wrong. No. To do what is good. So paying taxes, I might not like paying taxes, but I pay my taxes, and so do you. I might not like paying my bills, but I pay my bills because if I don't, if one day I decide, I don't feel like paying my bills. You know what's going to happen, don't you? Yeah, there's going to be a court order standing at my door. You owe this. It's not about how you feel. It's about what's doing right. And also, Paul also calls on believers to submit to their spiritual leaders and even to submit, listen to this, folks, to one another. So it's not only vertical to God, it's horizontal, submitting to one another. In Paul's day, Christian slaves were to submit to their masters and Christian prophets to other prophets. In each case, one person is to recognize the rightful leadership role that another human being has in his or her life. Hold that thought. Here's the next question then. What is the opposite to legitimate authority? Illegitimate authority, absolutely. And you know another word that accurately describes illegitimate authority? It's the word power. Legitimate authority and illegitimate authority, when they manifest as power, are simply not the same. They are actually opposed to each other. When legitimate authority that Paul was talking about in the first few verses becomes an illegitimate authority, it's corrupted. It is no longer the use of authority, but is now the use of power. And I don't know anybody that responds well to that kind of power. Take, for example, anyone here been to the Killing Fields in Cambodia? Yep, I have. Anyone been to them? Yep, you've been. Killing Fields. Pol Pot, the Pol Pot regime. Oh, it's just seeing is believing. What about Saddam Hussein? Just some examples. You know, Hussein, are you familiar with the phrase the night of the long knives? Okay, so what happened, this is when he came to power. This is Saddam Hussein. The light of the long knives was when he was maneuvering things so that he could take over Iraq. When he could take over and got all of the politicians, the two parties, the Sunni and the, don't know what the other one was, Shias, whatever, got them all together in this big setting, this big hall or what, and he was kind of directing the traffic and telling everybody what was going to go on, because a lot of stuff had gone on before that, of course, maneuvering and putting things in place. But all of the people who were going to be in opposition to him, all of those, and they're all men, all of them were taken out while he was speaking to this dressing, this huge audience, were taken out by his henchmen, one by one, taken out into the courtyard, and every one of them was shot that night. That's why they call it the night of the long knives. Illegitimate power. Illegitimate authority. What about Adolf Hitler? Here's a good one. Do you know when the Nazis took over Germany in 1933 that Germany was a democracy? Before that? It was. It was absolutely a democracy. And Hitler and the Nazis, through the use of power, took control and turned Germany into a dictatorship. Hitler never became Germany's chancellor through legitimate means at all. He became chancellor by removing all opposition through the use of power and control, eliminating all opposition by murdering them all, and eventually, and very cleverly I might add, through Joseph Goebbels, who was the Minister of Propaganda, seducing the masses to follow him for his vision of a thousand-year Reich. But his authority was taken illegitimately. He was established illegitimately. And Paul is not saying here that we are to blindly follow a personality, an organization, or a government that is exercising illegitimate power and control over the people. Paul is not saying that we are to keep silent and offer no resistance even in the face of flagrant abuse of authority. He's not saying that. In those instances, the church should stand up for truth and for justice. Would you agree? We should stand up, just as Jesus did. But we are also to obey those who mandate legitimate authority over us. As Christians, we are called to believe that civic authorities are there because the one true God wants his world to be ordered and not chaotic. This does not validate particular actions of particular governments. It is merely to say that some government is always necessary in a world where evil flourishes when it is left unchecked. Edmund Burke, you know that wonderful saying from the philosopher Edmund Burke, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So true. Yes, Paul says Christians are to submit themselves to those governing authorities who are appointed legitimately and rule legitimately. And in doing so, when we do that, we are actually doing God's will. Smile, everyone. That doesn't matter who you voted for in this election. They're in power, legitimately in power. Some of you are probably saying, I'm really glad about that. And others probably, well, I'm not sure about that. But they're in power. And according to this, according to Paul, God put them there. Some of you are probably asking this question then, is there then an exception to what I've just said? And the answer is yes. Because nowhere in Scripture are we called to submit to tyranny. When Paul wrote Romans, it was during Nero's reign. Nero came to power and maintained power by murdering his political opposition, persecuting Christians unto death, and even had his mother murdered. He was your classic tyrant, and Christians are not called to submit to the rule of tyrants. When governments order us to do something that's incompatible with our obedience to God's word, which is our higher authority, God's word is our higher authority. We must, as Peter and John said in Acts 5:29, obey God rather than man. That is the exception. Which segues into Paul's second and other main point. That is how believers are to express, in the midst of all of that, genuine love for one another. How are we to do that? Because, you know, when you're under attack, when you're under pressure, when you are from a government perspective, then in a regime like the whole Pol Pot thing, or the Nazis, or whoever, how many of you would find it difficult to love as Christ loved in that situation, apart from me? How many would find that difficult? We all would. Let's be honest. So how believers are to express genuine Christian love. Verse 8, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another, for whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. You know, the Bible teaches that our love for one another is the basic principle, the underlying foundational principle of the Christian life. When you choose to become a follower, when you chose to become a follower of Jesus, you also chose to love me. And I chose to love you. No matter what you think of me, no matter what I think of you. That came with the territory. That means that Christians then, Paul was saying, have a wider responsibility to let love be our guiding principle in all matters of faith and practice. And this love, by the way, church, the love that he's talking about here, is not about your rights. It's not about your rights. It's much more about doing what is right before both mankind and God. He's reminding the Roman church here, you've got to remember that Nero was in charge. Nero was a killer. He was a tyrant. And this church is brand spanking new, only a few years old, and they were just kind of getting going. And many people were coming to faith, both Jews and Gentiles were coming into this church. And Paul's coming along and saying, well, actually, in the middle of all of this cauldron of chaos, here's how we now should live. And he reminded the church of Rome of the commandment that Jesus gave in John 13:34. A new commandment I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. You know, if there is an inverse relationship between power and authority, which I explained before, and there is, so too, love and power are also opposites. Paul's point here is simply this. When we practice love as Christ loves us, there will be no need for any other laws. Because to love Christ as he loves us, that love covers everything else. Could you imagine if every human on the planet loved as Jesus loved? Could you imagine that? Utopia, isn't it? Well, it's not going to happen, not this side of eternity, but could you imagine if that did happen? There would be no wars, there would be no fighting, life would just be utopia. But unfortunately, it's not this side of eternity. Because love covers it all. But there's a flip side to this as well. And I want you to hold on to your seat for this one. Because I'm going to use marriage as an illustration. And it's not just not marriage, but I'm going to use it as an illustration. If we try to navigate relationship challenges the world's way, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, the one who has the most power wins kind of attitude, then relationship breakdown, I promise you, is sure to follow. I want to illustrate the inverse relationship between love and power. There's a sociologist, he's now passed away, called Willard Waller, renowned sociologist, actually. You know what sociology is? The study of human relationships, behavior, human to human, social relationships. Waller is recognized for his significant contributions to sociology of marriage, divorce, and the family. Well, Waller, in his younger years, his parents went through a divorce. And as a sociologist, when he got older and went to university and studied to be a sociologist, he wanted to understand what caused the breakdown between his parents from a sociological perspective. So he did some research on it. Because as a young man, he had gone through the inevitable emotions that come from when people go through marriage difficulties, particularly if it leads to separation and divorce. Emotions like fear, rejection, loss, anger, confusion, anxiety. You know, this is a great one. It's my fault that mum and dad are breaking up. That's a classic one. And Waller, in his effort to try to make sense of what had mostly contributed to his parents' breakdown of their marriage, their failed marriage, he made a very simple yet profound observation, as to why they could not resolve their differences. And this was Waller's conclusion. He actually wrote a book on it, I think, called The Delusion of Power, or The Power Delusion. Can't remember which one it was. And this was his conclusion. Listen to this, church. Where love increases, power decreases. Where power increases in a relationship, love decreases. Let me explain this. For example, she will do anything to make the marriage work. Even though she doesn't like his behavior, nor should she still loves him and her vows mean something to her. He, on the other hand, he could care less one way or the other. He doesn't feel any love for her, so he's unconcerned whether she stays or she goes. And if she stays, well, he's still going to do his own thing. At least he doesn't have to divide the assets, but he's going to do his own thing anyway. And if she goes, well, he can start over. No big deal. In this example, she loves the most because she wants the marriage to work. Doesn't like the behavior, but she wants the marriage to work. He, on the other hand, couldn't give one iota. Here's my question to you. Who has all the power? Him or her? He does. Absolutely. He has all the power. And by the way, that's also true when he loves the most and she loves the least. Just in case, ladies, you thought you were getting away with it. Doesn't matter what the situation is. Here's Paul's point. God's love is not based on power, but it's based on consistency. Verse 8, listen to this. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing, consistent debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. To be clear, let me just clear up a point here. I think this is absolutely vital you hear this too. The Bible does not teach that if you are in an abusive relationship, and that I mean emotional and physical and mental and any other abuse you want to throw in there, does not teach that for love's sake you should stay in the relationship at all cost. Doesn't teach that. Jesus never said that. We also need to be safe, which most certainly will require making a tough call at some point for your immediate health, well-being, and safety. Absolutely. When I first came into ministry 20-odd years ago, one of the very first principles that I operated by as the pastor of that church was that if someone came to me, whether it was the man or the woman, made no difference, and they were in a marriage, challenging marriage situation, and they were unsafe in any way, my advice to them, get out. Not get out of my office, get out of the marriage. Get to a safe place. We will walk with you. We will work with you. We will do whatever we can do as a church to support you in all of this. But please get to a safe place. Once you're in that position, then we can do something about it. But not while you stay in it. That is not wise to stay in it. Now, you can choose to stay in it. But when you choose to stay in it, there are consequences that come. You've also chosen the consequences, whether you like it or not. Get to a safe place, and that may be physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever. It might be all three. But while you're in there, then we will help. Then we can help. Then we can do something. I can't stress that enough. If, on the other hand, both parties choose to stay and exercise this kind of love that Paul is talking about here, that he's describing here, it is that love that will win the day, and pretty much the relationship will be restored. If we do this God's way, if we do it His way and not the world's way, chances are, pretty much, the relationship will be restored and love will win the day. The love of Christ will win the day. And notice I said, if both parties exercise this love. If one partner chooses God's way, which is the way of love, and the other chooses the way of power, which is the world's way, the chances of reconciliation are almost zero. Do you know how I know that to be absolutely true? Because I've been through it. I've been there. And then I came to faith in Jesus Christ, and everything changed. And now I've been married for 35 years. So what I was about to say, Leon, was, and I'm looking forward to number 36. I was just about to say that. And it just keeps getting better. You know, Waller's conclusion regarding love and power as it relates to marriage, where love increases, power decreases. Where power increases, love decreases. If that's how we approach reconciliation, I can guarantee you this morning it will be doomed to fail. Finish with this. The love and power thing. Remember Jesus and his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane? After they'd spent the evening together, broke bread, and he said, "One will betray me." Then they went to the Garden of Gethsemane and he prayed, remember? I think that's what happened. They fell asleep. Then he came back and they woke up and he woke them up. And then the Roman soldiers came because he'd been betrayed by Judas. Roman soldiers came to arrest him. So they're standing there, a bit of a face off. They've got the Praetorian Guard there, Jesus and the 12 disciples. And Peter drew his sword. Remember that story? Remember that? Peter drew his sword. What did he do? He cut off the ear of one of the soldiers that was there. In his effort to defend Jesus, by the way, and Jesus said to him, "Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Matthew 26:53. A legion is 6,000. 6 12s are 72. A lot. You know, the Praetorian Guard, it wouldn't matter if it was one of them or 50,000 of them. One angel could probably take them all out. And Jesus said, "I can get 12 legions of those just like that, just at a word." But when it came to the choice of either love or power, what did Jesus choose? He chose the way of love. It was love that won the day. And it will continue to win the day until he returns. Verse 10. Let's read this together. Verse 10, which should come up on the screen. That's all right, mate. I might have pushed the wrong button when I was doing this. Find it in your Bibles, please. Or your iPad or your iPhone. Romans 13, verse 10. Okay, what it says is, let's read it together. Love does no harm to its neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. And Paul rounds off this section by proclaiming, only in Christ Jesus can a person meet this or any other requirements of the law. It is only when we invite Jesus into our life that we can love that way. You cannot do it with human endeavor. You just can't. The world's tried that, and it's not doing a very good job at it. It's only when we love as Christ loved us. And for that to happen, you actually need him in you to be guiding and directing you, to give you the strength that you probably don't have yourself, to give you what you need to win this fight, to win this relationship, to keep this relationship according to the vows that we said or you said. When both parties, doesn't matter what the difference is or the width of the divide between the two of them, when you do it Christ's way with this kind of love, Paul says, the outcome is guaranteed. You try it any other way, chances are you're going to fail. Please bring the team up, Stu. You know, when all is said and done, church, it's God's love for all humanity that will ultimately overcome the powers of this world. You know, in our lounge, is that slide there? In our lounge, we have this on our wall. Christine bought that for me as a reminder. I love that saying. I love that saying. When I walk past, I'm in the lounge often, so it's there. It's a reminder. When you always put love first, not the Hollywood love, not that nonsense. I mean the love of Jesus, that love that bridges all gaps. That love that levels all playing fields, all emotional playing fields, all the challenges that we have in marriage. 35 years married, do you think we've had our moments? She married me, so clearly there's going to be some moments. You know, I'm the guy that said to Sergeant Rob, no, let's not go there. Actually, I must tell you just one little story. Okay, darling, you're not in it. You're not in it. I hadn't even met you then anyway, so there we go. Yeah. So we're part of this training thing was we had to learn how to use rifles and ammunition, all that kind of stuff, and it was brilliant. I loved it. And we're down at the rifle range, the 100-meter rifle range, using these very high-powered rifles. I don't even know anything about rifles, but it was a 308 caliber, semi-automatic. Terrific machine, this thing. So anyway, I was a reasonably good shot, reasonably good at what I did, because I did a lot of deer stalking that before I joined the armed forces. And we're down at the rifle range, and my friend Austin, the guy Austin, he was on my left, and he was a useless shot. He was hopeless. And he was trying to qualify to become a marksman. And I'd already qualified for that and had the badge and all the kudos that went with it. It was very nice. So I'm beside him here, and he's there. We're lying prone on the ground, 100 meters away is the target. And there is some, at the target end, there's these guys who are below the mound. So they're very, very safe. They were below there, the mound, a big, huge mound of dirt. And they had these pointers, you know, a big white diamond on the end of a stick, like a tomato stake. And where your bullet went, they would point there so you could see it from 100 meters away. You could see if you're on target or not. So anyway, poor old Aussie, he had missed the target a few times, and he's quite upset about this. And we're firing our rifles, and I thought, I'll give him a hand. I'll help him out. So I'm looking down here, and I just come across that way, and I put a bullet into his target and went into the right spot, and the white pickety thing went up in the air, and Austin, this is great. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for helping me out. He said, I need one more. So I'm doing my thing, and he fired and he missed, and I flicked my rifle around again just as the guy was putting up the pointer, and I hit the thing, and it blew off and just went all over the place, and guess who was standing behind me? I tell you. Scrubbing toothbrush. Anyway, please stand.